This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Coming up on this week's show, the first new Commodore product arrives.
A rare Mega Drive game gets re-released.
And we chat Virgin and SCI with this week's guest, Dave Isherwood.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our friends, our incredible sponsor at Bitmap Books. Now, one of the games we're going to be talking about with this week's guest is the Broken Sword series. Now, if you love that, a book from Bitmap Books you need to check out. The Art of Point-and-Click Adventure Games. Now, weighing in at a massive 528 pages, this gorgeous hardback coffee table book covers all the big games from back in the day in that genre. King's Quest, Myst, Blade Runner, Gabriel Knight's in there as well, of course, Monkey Island, The Dig, Simon the Sorcerer, and lots more as well, and featuring over 50 interviews with key developers, designers, and artists who were behind some of the most beloved games in that genre. So you can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 489, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, the podcast that every single Friday brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology. And of course, welcomes on more veterans of the industry for an interview on part two of the podcast. Now, today, we're going to be talking about a subject that actually we don't think about all that much, but is extremely important. You know how gaming works in 2025? You buy a new game for your Xbox or your PlayStation or your Switch. You often get a massive compulsory day one update. Had it before, like buying the new Call of Duty. You put the disc in and there'll be like an 80 gigabyte update before you can even play the game.
A whole new game on top of the game you've already bought.
Pretty much, because, you know, they can put games out broken. If we're honest now, then patch them on day one. But that was something that you couldn't do back in the 80s and 90s. And back then, even more than today, I'd say, game quality assurance was extremely important because no internet updates, you know, you couldn't really patch a game or anything like that. So today we're going to be talking to someone who was at the forefront of making sure the games we played as kids were up to scratch.
Yeah, so this week we're talking to Dave Isherwood. And it's really interesting talking about QA because it's changed a lot in the years, you know. Doing it originally, they were recording it onto video and sending it to the developers. Now you can have like a open beta or a closed beta. You know, you've got people from all around the world, people online looking at it, finding bugs, eliminating that. But this was a few people in a studio in Virgin Interactive, SCI as well, and IDOS, you know, going through these titles, finding all the little errors and essentially like speed running them. Yeah. And doing long plays, which now is on YouTube and it's kind of done for pleasure. But these people were doing it for work. And it's really interesting to hear the kind of backstage and the stories behind what they were doing in QA.
Because when you were a kid, I don't know about you, Joe, did the idea of being a games tester ever appeal to you when you were a kid?
I don't think I ever realized you could do anything with games. Like, I just thought it was this like magical like thing, you know, that just happened in like America or Japan. I don't think it ever crossed my mind that, you know, anybody from the UK could be involved in it in any way.
It's interesting because Dave actually said they were testing pretty much all the games that came via Europe and everything were all coming through Virgin offices in London. It's interesting because a friend of mine, I remember about 2005, my friend Ant, he actually got a job as a games tester for Sega. And he worked out of their London HQ. And I remember at the start, he's always been a massive gamer. He's so hyped for it. But actually, because obviously all the game devs are in during the day, they actually made all the games testers go in on the night shift. So he'd get there about 10 o'clock at night and he'd work till about 6 in the morning. They'd supply him with like unlimited pizza, as many fizzy drinks as they needed to get through the night. But he said
very unhealthy, done.
Yeah, he said it nearly killed him after a few weeks. So it wasn't necessarily all it's, all you'd imagine it to be. But actually, Dave's got some really interesting stories from that era because, what Virgin were like back in the 90s, they pretty much seemed like the most rock and roll brand you could think of back in the day.
Yeah, he started with some of the DOS titles and then, when the PlayStation started coming in, there were some great titles that he's working on there. Interestingly, there was a big kind of change at Virgin as well with EA coming in. There's games like Thrill Kill that he was working on, which was a game that kind of leaked. I remember it arriving on the piracy scene for the PlayStation and we're like, oh, have you seen this game? It's leaked, controversial one. Mm. Yeah, there was some interesting titles he worked on as well, like Doom 2000, which is a legendary game. The differences of working on real-time strategy games as well as them working on something like Broken Sword, which is a point-and-click adventure. How are you going to test those, How are you going to test a real-time strategy game and all the different combinations and styles of play? It's potentially quite a nightmare, actually, with all the graphics cards coming out and stuff. So it's a really interesting interview. And one game that he played on was one of Joe's favourites, and that was Resident Evil.
Yeah, you've got him to thank, Joe.
Got him to thank you. I'm going to have to give this one a listen and see what that's all about.
Yeah, so this week's special guest, Dave Isherwood, talking about game quality assurance at massive companies Virgin, SCI, Eidos as well. He's on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, first half of the podcast is when we have a bit of a nerd out about what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And this next story, I don't know, for me, I'm like, I know obviously a big part of being into retro gaming is owning a collection, whether that be, systems, computers, consoles, games, which, between us three, we kind of fall into all of those camps. So I know recently, Ravi, you've been downsizing your collection a little bit.
Yes, not to kind of, destroy my retro hobby, because I absolutely love it, but to focus on machines more, because I had so many, I'm like, actually get rid of some of them. Just focus on the ones you love and then you've actually got time. With life and stuff, it's quite hard to have all of these things. I want to have time to play on them, but, it's quite tough.
What about you, Joe? Are you looking for any more systems or are you up to the limit in terms of space and understanding wife?
I am up to the limit. I mean, most of mine has gone into the, into storage and packed away and stuff, but I've got the Sega stuff still on the go in my office and I think I have room for 8 games left on the shelf. So yeah, I am pretty much at the end of the road for collecting.
Yeah, so you've got to be selective when the room starts to get a bit tight. I do understand that. And for me, this is something that I absolutely do not need in my collection, being that I own the original. I also own a Mega 65, which is a modern FPGA-based Commodore 8-bit kind of a continuation. I had a Spectrum Next as well. But somehow, a big part of me really wants to own this. Now, we did talk on the podcast a couple of weeks ago that Commodore has potentially got a new owner. Of course, the original company going under in 1994, the patents and everything being spread over a multitude of companies over the last 30 years. But we did mention that Christian Perifractic Simpson, who we're big fans of on YouTube, has become the new CEO of Commodore and is in the process of acquiring the rights. Now, if you look at their website, which is commodore.net, some nice updates on there about the team, which we might talk about in a second as well. But the big story is that they've unveiled their first product, which they're calling the Commodore 64 Ultimate Edition. What do you think of this, Ravi?
I think it's a good price for what it is. It's a lot of existing projects that are already out there that have kind of come together to create this. It's not for me because it's far too advanced. And I remember getting a C64 for like 30 quid. So but if you're a real big collector of it and if you're into FPGA, it's got the board that was from the Ultimate C64. And then I think there's this fancy keyboard case, which I've heard it's the Blinky case or something, which is a Kickstarter that was released.
Yeah, I remember talking about that, yeah.
Yeah, so it seems like they've brought together a few things here, and these are pre-orders for the system at the moment. And interestingly, they've also put on the FAQ, will it be affected if the acquisition doesn't complete? Will the unit still ship? And they've said they've got a contract with the previous IP owners that says, regardless of the final acquisition outcome, the machines can be manufactured. And I think that's good, actually, because, if the acquisition doesn't go through, you don't want to leave a lot of people in the dry.
Yeah.
And I think, obviously, this has been pre-planned. They've planned it all beforehand and got all these deals together and stuff like that. It seems to be quite a popular price as well for what you're getting. I think what you're getting is very high-end, though, isn't it? It's like for the real, real hardcore Commodore guys, this one.
Well, we didn't mention the price, so the pricing, there's different variants of it, isn't there? So you can get a Commodore 64 Ultimate Basic Beige, which is the machine that looks pretty much identical to the original Commodore 64, the breadbox model, and that's priced at $299 US dollars. This is, if you go on euros, it's 249 euros, which I actually think, I mean, I've seen a few people complaining that it is pricey, but for me, I mean, I didn't buy one of these, but I did a quick Google because he said it's based on the Ultimate 64 Elite 2 board.
I think it's cheaper than the actual.
Well, it's $50 more than 50, the pricing I've seen on, but I mean, for that you get the case and the mechanical keyboard.
I think what was probably happened, if they probably said we can sell these many units, we'll do a deal mass kind of thing. The one thing that stressed me out was I clicked on it just to have a look, and it was like sales tax $60 or something. But I guess that's where it's based location wise, and there's taxes and tariffs and all sorts all over the world as well. So
whatever you buy, you're going to get affected by stuff like that, VAT, aren't you, and shipping and import and export duties. But then the next one, though, the Commodore 64 Ultimate Starlight Edition. I think for me, this, some people have said this looks a bit tacky, but I think this is probably my favourite looking one. Kind of a translucent case with rainbow LEDs in there. And
you mentioned that keyboard. Do they make it go faster, Dan?
That's it. Yeah, go faster LEDs inside. Which I think, looking at that, I don't know why, but we've talked about it on the podcast before, that I like the era of transparent electronics. You know, it was popular in like the late 90s, early 2000s, like the iMac and stuff like that.
They still have it in prison as well.
There you go. If you ever go to jail, useful to take with you. And then they've got the Ultimate 64, the Founders Edition of it as well, which is like a beautiful kind of yellowy orange kind of look, isn't it? Now
I guess this is like the high-end range compared to, like, you know, the Mini and stuff like that. It'll be interesting to see how popular it is. I've seen they've actually been publishing the sales charts,
which is very open and reassuring. I think the fact that they're doing that,
which is a pre-sale, a pre-sale, so none have been shipped yet and stuff, and we'll see how that process works.
The time recording was over 3,000.
I think so, yeah.
That's all, yeah, which is pretty good going for the first few days. And if you're not familiar with this system, it is a FPGA, I struggle saying that, based system. Been around for about 5 or 6 years, 128 megabytes of memory on there. It's got all the usual stuff you'd expect, HDMI on there. It also has USB ports on there. But also, interestingly, it's got the original Commodore 64 ports on there too, so you can use C64 cartridges and data sets and serial like disk drives and printers, and also you can load all the Commodore 64 formats, like, you know, D64, TAP files, .prg from a USB stick as well. So that really means you can have your entire Commodore 64 game library on a USB stick plugged into this and play them straight off that, which I think is very cool.
Which you could do with a Raspberry Pi or whatever.
Yeah, but the different, I mean, some people have been saying, you know, why wouldn't you just buy like the Retro Games Limited C64 Maxi, which is cheaper. The difference with that is it's software emulation. FPGA, it's hardware simulation, isn't it? So
you could probably do it with a Tang Nano, which is like dirt cheap as well. So, and that's FPGA. So,
but you don't get the sexy case and all that.
You know, you want your LEDs done.
I think, you know, the fact that they're coming out the gate with this, I did mention, you know, Gideon, who was actually behind the C64 Ultimate, he's actually part of their launch team looking at the list. They've got Leonard Tramiel on board as well, which I haven't seen announced anywhere apart from on their team page, as their chief Tramiel officer. Obviously made that title up from him. Colin Proudfoot's involved as well. Dave Haney on board as a technical advisor. So obviously it's very early days with this, but I think, you know, considering this has only been in the news for like, what, a week and a half? I think, yeah, strong, yeah, strong opener.
I think strong for people that know Commodore. I'm yet to see strong business person in there. I'd like to see someone outside of the kind of community that, you know, has a huge, big business background that's not like heaped within legacy. But, you know, I'm always cautious when anybody announces a new Amiga or a new Commodore. And that's probably because I've heard it about 50 times.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's one of those things I've kind of been worn down by for the years. But I think this looks like a good price for what you're going to get.
Yeah, if you're in the market for an FPGA-based Commodore 64, then yeah, pre-orders for that are online right now. So I'll link that up in this week's show notes. We'll keep an eye on what the new Commodore are up to over coming months as well. Now, this could save you a few quid if you're in the market for a rare Sega Mega Drive game that was actually previously a Japan exclusive. I hadn't heard of this game before. But apparently this is one of the Mega Drive's most expensive and hard-to-get-hold-of games, a first-person shooter called On Deadline. Now, obviously, you're our resident Mega Drive fan. Joe, something you're familiar with before this read this story?
Yeah, I am aware of this one. I've seen it on ROM before. It isn't a first-person shooter. It's a top-down shooter, just to get that out there.
A shmup.
A shmup. A very, very difficult one. So not one for Dan, unfortunately. But yeah, so this game never came out anywhere other than in Japan. And then in Japan is, from what I understand, incredibly rare there as well. So Retrobit, which are a, you know, very much like, you know, kind of like Retro Games Limited, release retro games, you know, in fantastic quality, you know, re-releases of these games. But what they've been doing recently...
Limited run style thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What they've been doing recently is releasing some of the exclusive Japanese Mega Drive games, which I think is wicked because of, you know, the library is so... Well, I'm not too sure how much bigger it is, but I love kind of getting a hold of, like, exclusive Japanese games for the Mega Drive or exclusive Genesis games, ones that never came out in, you know, in power regions. Just getting them physical and just seeing them in the UK, I always think is just like funny. Like I love to see
it. It all seems to be a lot of shmup games as well. It seems like some amazing, and it was the same on Saturn as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of great shmups came up in that region of the world that didn't make it over here for some reason.
Absolutely. And, you know, and what's unique about it isn't a typical kind of like shmup that's like set in the future, you know, and you're a space, you know, spacecraft or anything like that. You are a knight fighting demons, etc. So it's very kind of like Ghosts and Goblins kind of style, but obviously it's a shmup. It plays very similar. I don't know if you've ever played Game Ground or if anybody's kind of familiar with Game Ground, where you're kind of like moving up the board, but then obviously like monsters and everything kind of like
reminds
demons.
Me of Gauntlet a little bit.
Yeah.
The style of it, yeah.
Yeah, the style of it, very, very similar to Gauntlet. But yeah, Retrobit are releasing this and it's up for pre-order at the moment and pre-orders go down on August 10th. But what's really cool about it is you mentioned there that you like the 90s translucent colours. It does come in a very nice, cool kind of like, it looks translucent blue cartridge, obviously with a full illustrated manual box and everything like that. And it also comes with some individually numbered slip covers and artwork as well. And the artwork is all very, very kind of like late 80s, early 90s kind of like sword and sorcery Japanese anime, which I really, really like.
It looks a bit like kind of hand-drawn, like, yeah, it looks a bit mad. It looks like very comic-y, manga-y,
yeah,
but not too cutesy stylized manga, kind of dark.
Yeah, it's very dark, very, you know, kind of like sword and sorcery. I really, really like this. I've, you know, there's quite a few mangas and animes out there which is kind of like based on this style as well, which I really enjoy. If you want to get a hold of this, so it is a North American release, you can get it in the UK, so you can get it, you know, shipped over and stuff. So it'd be $60 or €70 So I'm assuming with it being a little bit more expensive in euros, hopefully that covers sale tax, etc. Getting it over here, I'm not too sure. But it's cool to see, you know, one of the rarer, if not one of the rarest, Japanese kind of exclusive games, getting that outside of Japan release. It's the first time, the first official release of the game as well, outside of Japan. You know, it's always an interesting subject, which I always bring up when these games get, you know, kind of like re-released. Do they count towards the official kind of like PAL library, you know, or do we keep them separate? I know my friend Jason keeps them separate because he's going through the full kind of like PAL Mega Drive library. And if he was to include all these re-releases, he'll probably need about 100 more. Whereas if he's just going for the original set from when the Mega Drive was like out, he needs like 8 more. So, but it's still very, very cool to see.
You can only fit 8 on your shelf, Joe, as well. Yeah. So if you're thinking of it, you know, you'll have to select carefully.
Yeah. And then I guess they'll be like limited, won't they, as well? So, you know.
Yeah, they usually do a couple of thousand of them. They haven't said how many are doing of this. It might just be however many they get pre-ordered. So, and then round it up to the next 1,000 or something like that. But yeah, they usually are only a couple of thousand when they get these limited runs.
Yeah, so pre-orders are open right now until the 10th of August. So you've got just under a month if you want to get hold of one of those. So I'll link that in this week's show notes. Now, this looks very cool as well. If you're a fan of Worms, which I do love Worms. To me, it was, you know, an Amiga game. Obviously, it started on the Amiga. That's the system that I played it on. Did play it a bit, you know, on other systems were a bit later on, including the Dreamcast. I've been playing that quite a bit in the Dreamcast.
Bit of Worms World Party, Dan.
Yes, yeah. That was kind of our Prinks, I think they call it, pre-drinking game back in the day. I must admit, I haven't played it on the original Game Boy.
I didn't.
I'll be honest, it makes sense because it was kind of one of those games like Lemmings, it was ported onto everything. Makes sense that it would have come out on the Game Boy Classic back in the day. But actually, kind of game that obviously graphically wasn't too demanding. Makes sense that it would work on there. But apparently, it didn't have many levels on the original Game Boy. But someone's remedied that now.
So looking at this, the Game Boy version looks absolutely beautiful. Like, the whole concept of Worms, it works really well on the Game Boy. And I think I missed out not having a Game Boy and not playing on this because I was a huge Worms fan. Looking at the way that it plays, it's very zoomed in, but the levels kind of had that procedural generation on the Amiga that I remember. You know, you click that, you click onto the next level and it would draw one using certain elements from background sets. And I don't know if on the original Game Boy one, it had that procedural generation, but it seems to have procedurally generated levels on this Worms Forever ROM hack. It's really interesting as well, because when each of those levels was generated, you'd get a seed. So you'd have a landscape number and you could write that down, and then you're able to actually insert it again and get that kind of generation. So if there's a level that you really like the design of, that you really like playing on, you can keep kind of going back to that. So it's kind of a bit like a little old school save system.
Right.
Where, you know, you're writing the name down on it. It's also got some fan-made levels in there, which are always really cool. I remember on Worms on the Amiga, they had the DIY levels, and those were ones that you could draw in Deluxe Paint, and you can do that. So I guess there's some kind of Game Boy editor, or people have made it, or they've kind of designed that. And I'd love to see what the Game Boy levels are like and how different they are as well, and some of the innovations in them. Is this something that you'd like to try out?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually got an original Game Boy.
Which
is an oversight of my collection. You guys are downsizing. I'm thinking I might need to add that to my collection now. I've actually got a Game Boy Pocket, so it would work on that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, it's like it's the kind of game that I do associate more with playing it with a mouse and keyboard. But I think it's cool for what it is. This is by a guy called Ison, who's put this together. You can download it off romhacking.net. He does say the original Worms for the Game Boy featured 24 levels to play on, but there are about 4.2 billion possible ones as well using this procedurally generated level. So Yeah, you're not going to run out of them anytime soon.
No, it makes the game last a lot longer, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And also, he did a few other things in recent years as well. He did a mod called Worms Plus for the Game Boy, because apparently the original Worms for the Game Boy had no wind, but now there's like custom wind and power meters and stuff on there as well. So kind of really adds to it as well. I think, you know, it's kind of, if it's a game maybe you've had on the Game Boy since it first got released and you want a kind of new dimension or to breathe new life into it, I do think that's very cool. So that is available now as a free download on romhacking.net. I'll put that in this week's show notes. Now, we know that you're a big fan of the beat 'em up, Joe.
Yeah,
and this is a new collection, which looks pretty cool to me, actually. I do like a good side-scrolling beat 'em up as well, if I'm honest. But this is seven Cubite classics that have all been put together in a single pack, including something I did used to love back in the day, First Samurai and Second Samurai. A part of this new collection.
Yeah, this is a this collection is really cool. So I try to stay positive, like, but the games that are on this are definitely like the weird beat 'em ups that you'd play at your cousin's house like once in your childhood, or may have played once on like the Amiga or something. Like, they're not the typical like Streets of Rage, Final Fights, yep, kind of thing, but also like it's kind of why I love to see this, because it's like it's the very, to me, I could be wrong, maybe you guys are more familiar with these games, but very kind of like obscure beat 'em ups that you don't see get much attention.
There were games that were big back in the day, definitely. I remember First and Second Samurai getting a lot of love back then. Raphael Sekko, Psygnosis, wasn't it? But you're right, the games that are not really talked about as much anymore, I suppose.
Definitely Sword of Sodan as well. I think that was quite popular.
Yeah, Sword of Sodan's probably the only other one on there that I'm familiar with. But yeah, this is the Cubite Classics collection, which came out on July 17th, so a couple of days ago at the point of release. And it's going to be £20 on Steam, you know, Xbox, PlayStation, etc., which is cool. But you get First Samurai, like Dan says, Second Samurai, Gourmet Warriors, Iron Commando, Legend, Sword of Sodan, and The Tale of the Clouds and Winds, which I think I have played briefly on another compilation before. So I think that's pretty cool, like from a kind of like money standpoint for £20, like getting all those games is pretty cool. Just like I say, they're just not the most like popular titles in the world, I don't think, but it's also cool to see them getting the love and an all in one package. But it's interesting because they did do a First and Second Samurai kind of re-release package about a year or two ago on all modern systems. So I guess if you've already purchased them, it'd be a bit disappointing if you kind of have to buy it again. Unless sometimes, I know on Xbox, if you already own something that's part of a bundle and it's been released by the same, you know, like distributor, the same company, you do get a discount. But I've not had a look at this yet to see if that's the case.
I wouldn't hold your breath.
No, I wouldn't hold your breath either. But it's definitely cool to see, you know, some different games getting some love, you know, because how many times have we seen, as much as I love them, Streets of Rage, Final Fight and stuff, but they must have been re-released 20 times in the last 10 years alone.
And you've bought them every time, Joe.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like I said, looking at that list, I mean, I did say then I'm a fan of beat 'em up. I've only actually played two of them. Yeah, First and Second Samurai, the only ones I've ever played off that list. So I think looking at the screenshots, they do look really nice, actually, the graphics on these and the style of them. So I think, it, you know, if maybe you're like me and you haven't played any of these, it's basically for £20, you're getting a load of kind of classics that you probably haven't played before, that you can experience with it. You know, they've got the modern kind of conveniences on there. You've got rewind functions, controller remapping, screen filters, digital manuals, unlockable cheat codes as well. Yes, I think, for a collection, that if you're a beat 'em up fan, and you want to play someone that maybe haven't played for many years or never before in my case, then it looks really cool. So that is available now. Now, it's one more story before we hop into our interview for everyone else. Patrons get a few extra ones. Dave Isherwood on the show in just a minute. This one that I thought was worth mentioning because obviously we're used to seeing YouTubers getting copyright strikes on their channel, particularly for covering Nintendo games, usually, isn't it? They don't like people showing off their IP. But this is a Italian YouTuber who, it seems, might be facing something a little bit harsher than a takedown of his channel. He's a retro gaming YouTuber called Once Were Nerd, and actually had his house raided by the Italian government and is currently being sued by them for owning consoles that came with preloaded ROMs and showing these off on his channel.
Yeah, it's interesting, this one. He's been showing a lot of these Ambinic consoles and ones that come with the kind of preloaded games and titles on them. It looks like, I don't know why this has happened. Maybe it seems like maybe there's pressure from companies to kind of stop it happening with ROMs. Like, we know Nintendo are very high pressured.
Well, it does mention them in the writ that he's got. It basically says it specifically mentions reproductions of copyright materials from Nintendo and Sony.
So maybe there's been, okay, the only action I can think of that's like this is when the music industry started doing those MP3 kind of, you know, getting someone for downloading loads of nursery rhymes or something and then charging £1 million each track and making an example of them. And I think maybe this channel was kind of, you know, going on the edge of stuff. We've seen MVG used to do coverage of, you know, hacking the Switch and stuff. And then he said, I'm not going to do any coverage of that homebrew kind of Switch stuff because, you know, Nintendo really didn't like the videos. Maybe they're trying to kind of turn the screw on stuff like these emulation things, and maybe the Italian government's kind of gone in and, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything, but kind of gone in there and you know, said, right, let's make an example of this guy, get some headlines, you know, scare a few people. We've seen people running ROM sites get done, get raided, get, you know, there was that couple that were running, I think it was ROM Universe. They got really taken down, but they were distributing them. I think it's different buying something with them on already. There's always that weird rule that, like, you know, if you buy a dodgy bike off someone and you kind of know it's dodgy, you're handling stolen goods, and you can get done for handling stolen goods even though you don't know it was stolen, or you could plead innocence. It's a weird thing. What do you guys think?
To me, it's like, it seems like obviously he's bought these devices preloaded, which I guess in the eyes of the law doesn't make it right. So you make a good point there that, you know, technically, I suppose he's handling stolen property. But I don't know if you're the same. I mean, obviously, I look at a lot of retro gaming stuff on social. Do you guys see these on Facebook all the time? I get fed adverts for like these kind of preloaded consoles with thousands of games
constantly,
like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, they are advertising these to general people. I did actually take the mic
on one
of them recently.
But then maybe, if it's like the government, maybe they're saying we're enforcing trading rules or laws or something like that. But I guess I can't stop what's getting delivered to people. Do you remember that device, the Scorpion one? Or like, you know, it was illegal to have disc copying devices and stuff like that back in the days, wasn't it? But ROMs seem to be something that's kind of freely distributed, and yeah, it's just weird receiving it but not giving it out. I'd expect if he was going, come to my house and, you know, take a copy of this, it might be a bit different. But kind of just showing what you've received.
What do you think, Joe? I mean, would it put you off owning one of these? Would it kind of scare you off from buying one if someone offered you one?
No, not really. Like, I wouldn't be like putting it all over the internet that I've got one for a start. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And reviewing it, etc. So it wouldn't put
but
me off.
I'm
not
really. But we've mentioned it on the show quite a few times.
We could be going down now.
We could be going down. True. I could imagine it's kind of the one thing that, like, you know, your grandma would be like, I've bought you a video games console, and then get hand you it over.
And a SWAT team comes through our living room
descends,
window.
Yeah.
All come smashing through the windows. Ropes.
Yeah, so pretty spooky.
Grandma, what have you done?
Or when, as soon as you open it, she just gets a little microphone, like she just gets a walkie-talkie out, and she's just like, the cat is out of the bag.
Yeah, she's working with them, undercover granny. Yeah. He's filming that somewhere. But yeah, I think it's obviously one, you know, very far step beyond kind of YouTube takedowns that we're all used to. The fact that people are basically facing full-on legal action just for showing them off on YouTube, that could kind of set a rather scary precedent if he kind of does go to prison or something for this.
But which, then, like, look at archive.org, you know. Yeah, look at,
they're getting sued all the time, aren't they?
Get those lawyers to represent.
I think there's much bigger fish to fry. That's my only problem with it.
I think, like Ravi said, it might be like the music industry did, you know, when they used to pick on like a, you know, a teenage boy had like download a Backstreet Boys song, and then his single mum, who like was working three jobs, would get sued for like $50 million.
Yeah.
Because it was on her internet collection. It's like, you know, yeah, so quite scary, I think, but a story we'll definitely keep an eye on. So I want to read that. And all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around the Save of the Job every week by putting them in the show notes on your podcast app, or you can head to the Retro Hour.com. Now, before this week's special guest, Dave Isherwood, on the way in just a minute, just a second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor. It is, of course, a regular supporter of this little podcast, our friends at Shopify. You know them, the ones with the very catchy sound of making money. Because at the moment, it feels like a load of my friends are starting up kind of side hustles or doing their own thing, or maybe even you're starting your own business. Obviously, when you do that, there's a load of stuff you need to figure out. For example, if you're starting your own podcast, you know, you've got obviously your setup's got to be in there, your schedule, got to get your logos, your websites, any business you do. The start of it's really overwhelming. But there is one thing that you can do that would really tick off the to-do list, stop it from growing even bigger, and a task that can easily overrun your life. But you can find the right tool that will simplify selling. So obviously that's a really important thing for most businesses. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Now, they are the all-in-one commerce platform powering millions of businesses all around the world, including household names, Mattel, Gymshark, use them as well, to just as importantly, loads of small brands and businesses that are just getting started. Now, obviously we've been selling our books on there for the last year. Thing about it I love is it is literally possible to make a Shopify page look absolutely gorgeous. I've had friends that have done it on their laptop, you know, in a coffee shop on their lunch break before. It's that easy to use.
It's great because you can set it up really well. You know, you can do stuff like discounts and big deals, and also like estimate taxes as well for the countries. The checkout is absolutely amazing. And it's got that 24-hour support as well. You know, you're not stuck there trying to work out what to do. You can contact someone straight away, but also you can scale up as well. So you can start small and then build up, do a lot of stuff, and then, you know, publish it later on as you kind of expand.
One thing I love about it as well is I've got hundreds of beautiful looking templates as well. So it's basically having like your own design studio, isn't it? It'll help you build a beautiful online store that really matches your brand style, and your custom fonts and colors and stuff there too. Packed with helpful AI tools as well, so they can help you with your product descriptions, your page headlines, even make your photography look beautiful as well. And help you get the word out too, do stuff like, you know, your email and social media campaigns, get across all those platforms where your customers are. Get in front of people. So if you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. And of course, we've got you an incredible offer like we do with our sponsors. Why don't you try it out for just £1 a month? If you sell anything at all in person or online, because there's little point of sale systems as well, you can take to trade shows and that kind of thing. It's a no-brainer to give this a go for just £1 a month. Use our link to know that we sent you. Helps out the podcast. Head to shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase. I'll put it in the show notes so you can click straight through. shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and get ready to hear a lot more of this. All right then, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's podcast. And next, going inside the world of quality assurance on games back in the day, and inside stories from companies like Virgin, SCI, Eidos as well, with our special guest, Dave Isherwood. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Dave Isherwood. And Dave's worked with some fantastic companies, Virgin Interactive, some great games back in the days, back in the PlayStation era as well, and then SCI and Eidos as well. He was a quality assurance supervisor. So, you know, we're going to be talking about the whole game testing process and, you know, kind of what went on behind the scenes, all those decisions that were made on video games. How are you doing, Dave? Thanks for coming on.
I'm absolutely great. Thanks for having me. And yeah, willing to spill the beans on as much as I can, to be honest, and give you that insight behind the scenes.
Awesome. Well, we always love a bit of a, you know, backstage information here. And we've got a question that we always ask our guests first, and that was, what was the first like video game experience that stood out to you in your life? You know, something notable.
Goes back a long way. I was lucky enough to be there at the dawn of computer games, you know, and things like that. So I remember fondly days sitting at home on my Spectrum and things like that, and, you know, having all those different types of games and things like that. But I think generally when it comes to games and things like that, the kinds of things that blew me away more than anything else, I suppose, was the more immersive games that, you know, some of the computers weren't supposed to do at the time. Maybe Spectrum with things like Driller or even the Starglider games, which in my opinion sometimes the Spectrum versions are actually better than the Amiga or ST versions, but you know, that's just a me thing. But no, after that it was when we started seeing video in computer games, and just a huge seismic shift the moment we got onto PlayStation and the like and things like that. So not any one thing specifically, but I definitely remember my, you know, my youthful days playing in my bedroom with a black and white TV in my Spectrum. Yeah.
Was the Spectrum your first machine then? Because I'm interested. Everyone's kind of got a backstory on how they got their first system. What was yours?
Yes and no. Basically, back in the day, my dad used to work in computing and things like that. He was one of the people that actually helped sort out the DVLC, as it was back then, the DVLA now. And he actually changed it from the paper system into a computer system back in the late 70s. So we actually had a computer back in the day, even before the Spectrum, and it was something called a Microtan, which later evolved into an Oric computer and things like that. But that was the first computer I actually had experience with. But of course, you know, I was taken along to one of the micro fairs. I was shown this Spectrum and I sort of nodded in agreement. And a few months later, one turned up at the door and the rest was history. So yeah, my own personal computer that I didn't have to sit there writing a tape loading mechanism was the Spectrum, and I loved every day of it.
And did you start programming on there as well and playing around with things?
Yes. We were supposed to, weren't we? You know, it was like, oh, this is supposed to help you for your homework and the rest of it. And, you know, like every other kid, we all played games. But eventually, you know, there's a couple of times where you're playing a game and you think, you know, I just want to do something different, change your graphic. What can I do? Can I do sound and things like that? And, yeah, I had a play. I must admit, I wasn't very good, you know. And, of course, I like to concentrate on just one thing, and that turned out to be sound. But overall, you know, I was just enjoying my life. I was still going through school after all, you know, was very young. So I just grew up with the whole thing. I only started to leave school around the times of the Amiga and the Mega Drives and things like that. So, yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned sound, because you're in a sound studio at the moment, and before you joined Virgin Interactive as well, you were working in a studio. So how did you know, computer technology help with that and stuff?
Oh,
like the Amiga,
massively thing. So computers way back then, when I was first working in studios, we were looking at Atari STs, you know, MSX computers. Admittedly, you had Commodore 64 computers out there, but incidentally, they were actually inside the recording desks, the things that move all the sliders up and down. So yes, there was some form of that, but no, it was all of this sort of sequencing to a computer on a MIDI stream and things like that. And nowadays, you know, you can push a button, it can do half the stuff for you. You've got break beats, everything. That, no, back then we had to deal with it all ourselves. You know, the best when it came to actual digital audio was probably recording a stereo mix and chopping it up and calling it a 12-inch. That was it for the most part. But hey, at the time, I was just sort of almost working for food at the time, you know, hobbling the dole and things like that back then. And it was like parents turned around and said, look, you got to find a real job. And yeah, that one night I saw something in the Evening Standard and said, well, you know, have a laugh, let's apply for this. And lo and behold, a month later, they turned around and said, you've got the job. So yeah, fantastic news.
I was wondering how you kind of entered the, from working in a recording studio to entering the games industry, because you did QA for Virgin. So how did that come around? And were you a fan of Virgin's games before you joined the company?
Massively so, actually. Yeah, some of my favourite games were sort of sensible base games, you know, cannon fodder, just absolutely legendary.
Love them.
I was also into my LucasArts games and the point-and-click adventures. So, you know, Monkey Island was my life, and even games from the likes of Revolution in the, you know, Beneath the Steel Sky and things like that. Just playing all of those games and the rest of it. Didn't quite get into the likes of Dune because I was an Amiga owner back then. But, you know, equally it was a case of I was getting into those and had a real enjoyment of pretty much most of what Virgin did. They were, it was either, you know, even back then it was Virgin or EA, you know, the rest of them were quite niche markets in themselves. But fundamentally, yeah, it was just one of those adverts, do you want to test games? And I suppose every boy's wet dream is like, well, let's give it a go. And we went in, they sort of showed us a few games that were in progress, asked to write what we thought about it, any bugs we found and things like that. And they chose the good from the bad, and I was one of the good ones. And yeah, it started off a little team because at the time Virgin was scaling up their operations in the UK as well. They just moved from Ladbroke Grove. They were probably settling in Kensington Square. So that was my day of like living in the basement in Kensington Square, doing all the testing and things like that. So yeah. Good fun.
It's interesting you mentioned you had an Amiga at home as well. I mean, in terms of, you know, computer audio, the Amiga was, you know, a fantastic machine for audio. Were you experimenting much with that, like, you know, Soundtrack, Octomed, that kind of thing?
A lot. Yeah, Octomed, immediate memories and things like that, Soundtrack. I even had that Music X. You know, I wanted to get into MIDI and synths and things like that. And Music X was a bit of a hardship and things like that, but, you know... On top of that, I came from the Spectrum background, so I had sort of ideas with direct programming of AY synthesis on that, which incidentally was similar on the Atari ST, and equally quite a few synths and things like that. So you knew how to create the sounds and all the rest of it. But, you know, I also love just seeing how all of that hung together within an actual games environment as well. And, you know, later on down the line, we might talk about it. Broken Sword, managed to pull out some of my recording skills on that for editing and things like that down the line. But yeah, those skills always help and the rest of it.
I think Virgin was huge at the time as well. Of course, you had that music connection with Virgin Records. I was wondering what like the offices were like and the kind of culture in the offices as well. Was it a bit wild there, or was everyone quite sensible?
No, absolutely wild, absolutely wild. Now, obviously, you know, as someone like Virgin, I couldn't give you specific numbers, you know, but we must have had about 200, 300 people simply at Kensington. And I'd say the average for that average age was probably about 28. You know, we were very young. There was a lot of debaucherous kind of activity and things like that. But it was all in, you know, healthy excitement and the love of the game. You know, it's like you hear a lot of dubious you know, talk nowadays. Nothing was like that. You know, we all just absolutely loved to drink a good party and, you know, had fun with it. But of course, you know, there's a serious side that goes with it. And indeed, you know, there was some quite powerful people and, you know, a large group. Now, where I was, we, of all people, had Fergal Sharkey to a point next door. He was running a almost like an iTunes kind of extension to Virgin at the time. So the idea was that he was going to get bands in and things like that. They were going to be affiliated with games, part of the soundtrack, licensed and things like that. Behind the scenes, other things happened and the rest of it, but equally I was part of QA, just saw him passing and things like that, but no, just like sitting out there having a cigarette break and things like that back in the day, the amount of chat and gossip that you would hear around the whole office was fantastic. You know, it was a place to be sometimes, that little
that was pretty there. Cool, like having the undertones and stuff, you know, kind of involved. But also, like, I was wondering about the Virgin Megastores as well. Was there, like, a distribution network and a kind of agreement with them to put the titles out? Because I remember they were huge at the time, Virgin Megastores.
Yeah. Now, this is a little bit difficult and more behind the scenes. It was something to do with the way Branson runs his enterprises and things like that. But basically, Virgin as a company had handed over its reins to, you know, the likes of Sean Brennan, Tim Chaney and the others. So far as Branson was concerned, he just purely owned his signature on the Virgin logo. So he took a skim of profits and things like that. As far as Virgin Games or Virgin Interactive was concerned, that was its own entity moving forward. However, it's the whole point that, yes, there were still connections. So as one of my first Christmases was the UK release of the PlayStation. So as part of a bonus and your Christmas thing, you got something like 30% off at your Virgin Megastore or any Virgin branded place, as well as an automatic fee that you could have free as well. So, you know, I ended up paying something like £50 for my PlayStation on day of release, and it was like, Christmas had come early, of course, you know. So yeah, absolutely fantastic. The only downside about working in QA suddenly meant that I had to buy every console and games release that came out thereafter, so it did become expensive, but it was great fun all the same.
Well, getting back to your role there, I mean, kind of talk us through what the requirements were of being a good QA. I had a friend that did QA for Sega, and at first he said he was so excited about it, and then after like the 100th time of playing the same level at like 4 o'clock in the morning, it got old pretty quick for him. I mean, what was kind of the a typical day in the life for you doing QA at Virgin back then?
We'd all have our games and things like that that we were associated with and the rest of it. But fundamental points, where, as with any games tester and things like that, it's communication. Of course, you know, one of the first things you need to do is try and explain to someone just what's going wrong or what you're perceiving is going wrong on the game or something like that. So indeed, you know, you need to be able to articulate that either through actually speaking with someone or further to that, doing a write-up or something like that. Eventually, down the line, you start getting video assets and things like that that you can add to bug reports, etc. But you know, fundamentally, it's like being able to play a game quickly, effectively, get through all of the levels, potentially without cheat codes as well. Because, you know, yeah, back in the day, some of the cheat codes were put in for the testers just so they could get to that last level and make sure the bug wasn't there. But indeed, you know, if you play a game with all of your cheat modes on and bugs and things like that, then of course, you know, you're not playing it to the customer's experience. So you've got to play it as they play it. If you're playing with infinite lives and it's too hard, then they're not going to get the experience at the end of the day. So communication, I'd say, is the biggest skill, as well as being able to play a game in the first place.
I was going to say, did they test you on that, like, at kind of the interview process? Did they want to see, like, how good you were at games? Was there any kind of testing?
Yeah, to a certain point. Obviously, you know, everyone has different approaches. You don't always have to be good at games to spot there's a problem with games, you know. strategists, adventure gamers, all of that. But fundamentally, I would say that, yes, it's having to be able to play a game and things like that. Now, I wasn't the best Street Fighter person there. We had an awesome guy. His name was Steve. He could literally stand behind a game, listen to the sound effects, and beat you. Properly beat you. It didn't matter if it was Street Fighter, any of the Capcom games, or most especially Tekken and what was the other one? Mortal Kombat. Unbeatable. Couldn't touch the guy. We had another guy, Ron. He went on to actually have some involvement in the PlayStation I toy and things like that. But indeed, he had a photographic memory. He would analyze your moves, work them against you. You'd never be able to pull off the same thing twice. He was like that computer AI that you hated in the 90s. But again, fantastic bunch of guys. We all had our specialties. I was the sort of strategy guy, you know, other people were the fighters, other people were the racers and things like that. We all mucked in left, right and center to do as we needed, basically. But yeah, great days. And fundamentally, the core days of Virgin, I would say we must have had no more than about 15 core testers working at any time, and we pretty much did most of what went through Europe at the time. Yes, okay, you've got the other other territories, you know, doing their bits and things like that. But when it came to the UK, we had certain things we needed to test, you know. Does it actually play German when you select German? Does it play Italian when you do Italian and not Spanish? You know, we've all seen that bug before. But, you know, had to check all of things like that. So, again, communication all the way through.
I was wondering as well, did any of you guys enter any video gaming competitions? Because they would have done really well with those skills.
Yes and no. Yes, on account that, yes, we did enter competitions. We were there to, you know, enthuse and things like that. But when it came to, you know, the final challenges, the final throwdowns, no, we weren't allowed to take the top prize or anything like that, you know. Of course, it's like family, friends of employees and all the rest of it. So, yeah, there were times when, you know, you had to throw a game right and be really obvious about it and say, look, I could have beaten you, but, you know, rules is rules. There you go. But, you know, you always had the last laugh on the QT, you know.
I was wondering what you were working on then before the PlayStation, because you said you came in when the PlayStation came, but I heard you also worked on a Sensible Golf.
Yes. There was a re-release on floppy and Windows and things like that. You might remember that transition from, you know, DOS into Windows 95 or something like that. Yeah. And a lot more and more people were doing it. We had games like Tilt, which was almost like the Amiga Pinball Fantasies kinds of games. It was one of those. We did some of the Sensible ones where they were just basically trying to convert what they had on the Amiga over to a PC that could run Windows, because obviously there was a migration then in the mid-90s of Amiga owners wanting to transfer over to a PC because their games were starting to dry up and evaporate. So you had some of those. I remember vividly at the time there were a lot of problems with things like Sensible Golf and things like that, quite random issues. We some of us were quite inexperienced at the time, and, you know, needed some of the more experienced people to take the lead on it and things like that. But yeah, those times were hard. But indeed, we had so many other things going through at the time. You know, it was difficult to get bored with any particular one game. You know, there's, as I said, so much going on.
Well, Dune 2000 was a game that, you know, a lot of reviews at the time said was very ahead of its time, regarded today as a masterpiece, that game. I mean, what do you remember about working on Dune 2000 then? Was that a tough game to test, or how did that kind of go?
Yes and no. This was one of the times in my life, unfortunately, I have to look through with slightly gritted teeth. I was enjoying my time working on Tiberian Sun, especially Dune 2000. You know, I played Dune 2, loved every minute of it. I'd actually finally gotten a chance chance to have some kind of input with Doom 2000, and things were going really well. There was some quite horrendous AI issues and things like that, to be honest, but you know, we got them sorted out and things like that. And then unfortunately, one day I walk into work, I boot up Doom 2000, and someone taps him on the shoulder and said, don't do that, work on something else. And then, you know, that happened quite a few times that same day, that same hour. And then it's like, no, Dave, read your email, check this out. And it's like, all right, okay, yeah, so stop. And then find out that we've sold up to EA. And, you know, unfortunately, what they appeared to do was just take our bug reports, roll them up, scrunch them up, throw them in the bin, and start their own thing. I feel that was a big problem. You know, I think in that final release, you did see a lot of AI issues with tracking and things like that. And they were actually things that I had mentioned at the time. But, you know, I'm not going to hold a company accountable to, you know, what their developer is saying, what their publisher is saying. You know, that's a them problem.
It's interesting you mentioned the satellite to EA. I heard that was kind of internally known as Black Monday at Virgin. What kind of went down there then?
Absolutely. Oh, it was truly a sad day. You know, it happened. I've never seen it happen in a country before, in a company before. The entire atmosphere changed. It was like people were walking around. They didn't know what to do with themselves. They're even going into, you know, the CEO's office, asking for a quick squiggle in the signature saying, look, you'll give me a reference. Yeah, use my fax machine. Off you go. Who do you want me to send it to? And it was like that. We really didn't know what to do. People were scrambling. People were phoning friends. You know, do you have a job? You know, we're all on our ass here. What's going on? It was absolutely panicking. And of course, you know, just around the corner then, you had Christmas and all of those. So, you know, they scrubbed. The guy scrubbed it together, had a big knees up and celebration. It was actually quite, you know, sad and distressing in some respects. But, you know, it was a good kick out all in one big puff. And, you know, we enjoyed ourselves and sort of, you know, all raised a glass to what was once a fantastic company to work for.
It must have been quite tough having, like you said, those projects that you were working on and, you know, you'd kind of done a lot of work on, and then suddenly being told, right, stop on that one. One of those projects was Thrillkill as well, which is a notoriously odd game. I think there was a version leaked years ago. That kind of, I remember that coming out on the piracy scene on the PlayStation years ago. It was a kind of unreleased title. What are your memories of that and the kind of controversy that surrounded it?
Yeah, well, it was controversial. There was absolutely no question about that. But, you know, there was always rumour of this, like, really over-the-top game. And, look, there were some quite dodgy games running around at the time anyway. So we all wanted to know about this, and it was like going to, you know, for good or bad, it was going to change the way players played beat 'em ups, you know.
It was like that 90s shock era, wasn't it?
Especially well, yes, absolutely. Yeah. But believe it or not, we'd only ever seen two-player beat 'em ups or three-player if you include IK Plus. But let's not go there for the moment. This was the first four-player multiplayer game, you know, you had, except for Bomberman. So, you know, you couldn't do things like that. This was a new thing. So, you know, the guys and developers have been working on it for a while, you know, from time to time as they started doing a new character or something like that, you know, Pete or one of the other producers will come up and say, have a look at this, see what you think, you know, any ideas, what should we tell them? And quite literally, you know, we tell them. And then unfortunately we had this old, you know, EA have bought it, or what's happening to this? And it's like, well, the rumor is they've turned around and said it's never going to see the light of day. And it's like, well, what do we tell the developers? You know, they've been doing this for a few years now. What's going to happen there? Eventually down the line, it turned into Wu-Tang Clan. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, there was all of that, you know, obviously the rumor mill went out and you had people at EA turning around saying, oh, you know, I saw this game. It was absolutely heinous and no one should be doing it. So there was a bit of discussion about it. But, you know, when I eventually saw, you know, the image of the disc on there with the Virgin Interactive logo, I couldn't help but turn around and say, I know who that handwriting belongs to, but, you know, not going to name names, but, indeed, it was a classic game for its time, and it was one of the ones that you didn't want to show mum, or if you did want to show mum, she'd throw your PlayStation away.
I was also like wondering about Broken Sword as well, because we've interviewed many people from Revolution, and that game coming out on the PlayStation was so different in contrast to the other titles that had come out. What was it like kind of testing that, and you know, absolutely. Did you enjoy that title?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely, absolutely loved it. As we said just before we started, you know, I used to play point and click adventures and things like that. Beneath the Steel Sky was actually one of them. So I had a little idea of that. And then, you know, one day, one of the testers and one of the producers said, look, we're doing this. Do you want to come in and join? And even back then, we didn't have backgrounds, you know, there were line drawings, there were bubble characters waving their arms around and things like that, you know, handing over big things that looked like a cross or something like that, or, you know, very, very temporary stuff. And, you know, you could see the glimmers of a really good point and click adventure. And it's like, yeah, I'd really like to be part of this. And yeah, the rest was history. I got to see it from, you know, looking nothing more like something you put together in art class with a couple of like rough sketches and things like that, to a fully fluid animated thing. And you know, the diligence on that was amazing. You know, there were times where, you know, we as testers would turn around and said, oh look, if there's a tiniest of glitches between this frame and that frame, can you let us know? We want to polish it out, we want it to be smooth and things like that. And as I said, even up to the last minute, you know, you had the likes of Dave and Steve and some of the other script writers just going in and changing things because, oh, that didn't work if you hadn't spoken to this person, so we've got to add or adjust a little line there. Fantastic times.
It felt so polished, you know.
It was
a well-presented title.
Yeah, and to be honest, it was one of those where you felt like you'd had a history lesson by the end of the playtime. You know, it's like, I actually know something historically that maybe games shouldn't be telling me like this. So it did actually, you know, cut so many, you know, extra bits and pieces. But no, it was fantastic. And, you know, even some of the crunch times and things like that, they'd done all of their recording in the studio. They only had a couple of weeks to get everything recorded and ready to put on the disc. And, you know, some of us were there chopping down the samples, you know, just to line everything up so James and the rest of the programming team could go off and sort of assemble things, crunch things into these big files. And yeah, that was the audio that came out, you know. Some long nights.
So it's really interesting, because with QA, different titles have different approaches. I can imagine, you know, a point and click adventure is totally different to a real-time strategy. So when you're doing something like Warzone, you know, what was the approach to that? Was it like, get as many units, try to break it, try to, you know,
a bit
do it, yeah, in this kind of way, rather than you know, a platformer?
I remember at the time vividly, because there was still a lot of talk about Tiberian Sun at the time. You know, it's like EA had been holding on to this game for ages. I'd been lucky enough to see it and play it when it was a virgin. So, you know, I knew a little bit of background. Maybe I shouldn't have been talking about it, but, you know, I was turning around saying, look, don't worry about it. This game's actually much, much better. So they actually tried to really concentrate on the strategy side and things like that. And it's one of these that you can play it superficially and things like that, but you can even go in and start changing the way that various attack patterns will happen, the way things get detected. And, you know, if you're really cunning and clever, you could almost automate it so it plays the game for you. It takes a lot of effort to do it, but, you know, we try to make that possible. And I'm one of these that tries to understand that every strategist loves to play a game slightly different to the next person. So let people play in more than one way. You know, one game that springs to mind here would be Zed. This you know, just overhead, very simplistic thing. Great little game, great bit of fun, but it was a very simplistic, linear kind of game. If you didn't play it one way, it didn't really work. And I like games that were a bit more diverse and could be accessed from different ways. You know, if you want to play it differently, play it differently. We're not going to mess you about for it.
Well, speaking of Warzone as well, it was an interesting approach to RTS games. What did you think of the 3D style of that game? And did that cause issues?
It caused slight issues. The slight issues were a case of it was you could miss things by not looking in the right direction, you know, earlier on in the production cycle, especially on PC, we were getting loads of issues about, you know, the cursor not turning into the right icon or the right colour and things like that. And little silly things like if you had an AMD as opposed to a Voodoo card, things would happen and things wouldn't happen. It was crazy stuff beyond me, but, you know, the guys got it working. But again, you know, it's a case of it was all dependent on the what you're trying to look at the time. And yes, it was a whole new concept about, you know, looking at a 3D that you could cycle and turn and things like that. And that's what made it more appealing, I thought, in many respects than the rest of them. And I was so glad later on to, you know, hook up with the same team again and work on some other games.
I found that you're right about hardware settings. That must have been really hard with all the graphics cards coming out at the time and all the different hardware settings, especially on an RTS. I always found that RTSs were the easiest title to crash with stuff like Supreme Commander when the 3D came in and, you know, just thousands of units on screen.
Oh, absolutely. And I almost echo my sentiments that I said back in the day. Try and find out just what the testers are actually testing the games on. You know, some of them, yeah, they're using the latest, greatest, all singing, all dancing cards that you can't quite buy yet in the shops. But indeed, some of them have to test it on basic cards and things like that. And if you know which cards they're working on, they might not be the most bestest card on the planet, but they'll get your game running. And that was the same with us. You know, we couldn't cater for every possible sound card, every possible video card, every which way. So there were certain concessions made. And I think, again, this is why console games have taken off. You know, one PlayStation is exactly like the next PlayStation, exactly like the next one. But when it comes to a PC, you might have bought the same PC from the same shop three different times, but they all run in different ways and one of them will crash and you just can't explain it. You won't get that on a PlayStation or an Xbox or a Nintendo or something like that.
It's interesting as well because sometimes they'd release these graphics cards and they'd say it's going to do this and then there'd be something wrong in the manual or there'd be like, oh no, you've got to use this other driver. So were you often working with assumed setups like, oh, this is going to work?
Yes, and you know, one of our go-tos and standards that we insisted was always done every time before release. There was a game that came out that we forgot to do a test and got our bums burned for it. So quite literally, it was like we always insisted, even just between the testers, that we will go with the four major manufacturers and we will use their own straight off their website version. You know, we're not going to mess around looking for an alternate driver or something like that. We will use the driver on the manufacturer's website, even if it's 12 months old, we will use that. If it doesn't work, then we tell the manufacturer to get their, you know, get the house in order before we release. But at the same time, we know we have a line in the sand. And often, if it doesn't work, that manufacturer will give us a driver and say, look, can you put this on the disc when you release it? And back in the day, you saw those, you know, at least we know these drivers work on the disc, and that was the trick. And then, of course, DirectX came along and fixed a grand sum of problems there and then, you know.
It's always nice when you got a new version of DirectX on a game CD, because obviously internet speeds weren't fast back then.
Oh, absolutely. I remember just sitting there doing an update just in case, you know. It's like, oh, do I get something new today? But yeah, always there.
Well, how did you get onto working with SCI then? And were you aware of their history before you joined?
Yes, I was actually. Again, it was one of those niche titles and things, niche gaming companies and things like that. And I actually got in from a friend from Virgin. At the time, you know, I was at my wit's end at Eidos at the time, to be honest. I'd gone through some, you know, very difficult moments in my life and things like that. And the amount of work I was doing was taking me out of the game a bit. I'm not going to specifically mentioned titles, but there was one title that I'd literally put in over 300 hours of overtime on top of my natural working month. So you can imagine what kind of hours I was working. So, you know, even the doctor turned around and said, well, calm it down. So, you know, took a little bit of time out, things like that. And it's like, I can't keep this up. So moved over and called a few friends and said, is there anything a little less stressful that I can go with? And one of my guys at SCI went, you know what, this is just the company for you. And I went there and the rest was history. And then oddly enough, a couple of years, I think 3 years later, 4 years later, maybe, I came back because SCI had bought up Eidos and came in as, you know, some of my colleagues' boss. So, or rather supervisor, should I say. But, you know, it was a case of it was a great welcome back. But at the same time, you know, it was like great to be in the old place all over again.
But it really is interesting. It kind of shows the game industry, you know, you're in one place, you move, and then that place, you know, gets bought up and it becomes the place you were previously at. It's quite crazy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you even look at the industry now, you know, all of those people that worked in Virgin, you see where they are in the industry even today, and it's like, wow, you know, it's a rich tapestry of people out there. You've got, you know, big wigs at Sony that, you know, had humble beginnings in, you know, what seemed to be, you know, a little studio somewhere. But yeah, it was like there's some of the characters I've bumped into over the years have been, you know, frighteningly fantastic in their own right, you know.
Well, Carmageddon was an interesting series. I always enjoyed it. What was it like working on those titles as well? I think it came from the Isle of Man as well. There was a studio based.
I've got that dubious acclaim of working on the worst Nintendo game ever, isn't it? It's like, Carmageddon's up there. But indeed, you know, it was what it was, it is what it is kind of thing. I didn't do the original Carmageddons. You know, that was before my time. I was still at Eidos and even Virgin at the time, I think. But, you know, when the new versions turned up and things like that, and even the switchovers over to Nintendo 64 and Game Boys and other things like that, yes, had a minor hand in that. And whilst I don't wish to belittle the developers and things like that, even before even between the testers, we didn't want to play certain versions of certain games.
And we've talked to Stainless, we've had them on, and it was actually the Isle of Wight, but we've had them on before, and they've talked about, you know, the development hell with what went on later with the titles now.
And you know, the thing is, even from the testing point of view and things like that, you know, it was difficult, it was hard and things like that, but you couldn't ever fault the developer most of the time. You know, you turn around and said, look, we've got a problem, and 9 times out of 10, they'd actually give you a convincing reason either why they couldn't do something or indeed did their absolute level best to get it done. And, you know, Stainless were one of those many developers, actually, who really, you know, felt part and, you know, put their soul into their game. Even if other people didn't like it, there was some heart always went into it. And, you know, I was so lucky that so many of the games and companies that I worked with, everyone had that heart. You know, there was very few titles where it was like, well, you know, not many at all. Not many at all.
Another title that you worked on at that time was Galleon, and that was actually directed by Toby Gard of Tomb Raider fame. I mean, what memories have you got of that game then, and what did you think of it? What was it like to work on?
That was a crazy game. It was wild. It was not what I expected at all. We actually, to be absolutely fair, we had another guy, Hugo. He He was fantastic tester. He really did take the reins of that game. He was getting to places, and I was just watching him in awe. You know, he was able to do things in that game that not even I could do. But yeah, that was one of those. The biggest problem with that game was that you had to get through quite big chunks in order to find bugs later on down the line. So there's a lot of back and forth. You're only going to see this bug once in this entire playthrough. Otherwise, you're going to have to go back and do another 6 hours and get back to there. So it was, so far as we as testers were concerned, a very clever dialogue in time management and effective testing around certain areas and trying to keep tabs on what you're looking at and a specific order of you know, need and things like that, because we were quite short staffed for that particular game, you know, and the resources that you really did need for it. But again, you know, it's a case of the guys around me did a fantastic job, you know, the developers were knocked it out of the park, you know, they were doing things on that console that maybe shouldn't have been able to have been done that quickly. But yeah, they were just pulling it out of the bag every time. It was a great fun game to work on.
Another huge game that you worked on was Resident Evil. I mean, what are your memories there then? Tell us about working on that.
Loved it. Back in the day, well, it was Res Evil 1 when it first came in on the PlayStation. As testers, we were just gathered around our boss, who wouldn't really let it go out of his sight and things like that. Later on down the line, when there was a lot more push for it and things like that, got to play a little bit of it, but my cornerstone was the director's cut and the PC variant and things like that as they came out later. But then when the Resident Evil 2 hit, I was pretty much one of the main people there. Through more luck than judgment, to be honest, everyone wanted to play it, but everyone had their own games or projects that they were involved in. And I was literally between projects just at that right time. So yeah, Resident Evil was mine. And yeah, it was great fun sort of going around and sort of like giving a test, giving one of my colleagues and saying, have a look at this, see what happens, you know, play through it. And then that was the bit where the dogs would jump out of the window or something like that. They drop the pad and we go, yep, that works. Right, okay, next one. And we do a little tick box and saying, yeah, you know, for 4 out of 6 attempts, yeah, we're worrying people. And that then went on back to the developers and things like that. But no, absolutely fun times and the rest of it. We all wanted to play on it, and we all got our teeth into it, absolutely. But yeah, I got the lion's share of testing for the UK, certainly on that.
I think you were like testing and then doing it recorded to video.
That's
VHS,
it.
And then sending them off.
That
has been quite interesting.
One of the crazy things when it came to PlayStation back then is that obviously you would play the game and things like that, do all of your testing, and then you'd send it off to Sony or Sega or whoever it might have been. And so you send it off to Sony, and they can't afford to have a tester try and sit there and learn the game for 6 months, just in order to make sure there's no bugs in it. So they will often ask you to do a playthrough video so they can put a little VHS tape in and watch you play through it and go, that's what I need to do, and recreate it and carry on. Or sometimes, you know, if they're backed up against the wall, they might not play the game and just watch your video. But incidentally, when I was doing that, of course, we were limited on our videos and things like that. So I did the speedrun of speedruns and pretty much got the entire footage, Jill and Leon, and the replay that happens with Tofu Man and things like that, all of that literally on there. And quite literally when it came up right at the end and said, oh, your rank is S at the end, bang, video stops. So I managed to get all of it on that, you know, one, 120-minute, 180-minute videotape. So, yeah, the entire game is somewhere in video archive storage at Sony with me playing through it, yeah.
Nowadays, that would just be a long play on YouTube. And, you know, loads of people would absolutely love that. I think it's kind of mad that people are doing that for fun now.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But, yeah, you know, as you can imagine, 3 hours of your day literally sitting there playing a game, knowing that if you do it wrong, you're going to have to rewind and start it again, you know. To be honest, there were even some times where you know there's a bug, so you're just desperately trying to avoid it and not show the bug on video, because if that pops up, they'll fail you just by looking at the video. So, yeah, need to do some slight sneaky tactics as well, you know.
Did you spot many big bugs in games that then got swiftly changed?
Yes. There were quite a few down the line and things like that. And I think it's a little bit wrong to call, you know, any specific developer out. You know, they've all had specific issues and things like that. A common one back in the day was mixing up Italian and Spanish. You know, for us Brits, you know, it's like, well, you know, they sort of sound the same. So sometimes that used to happen. You'd often get sort of language translation errors back in the day, because they'd often use legal people. They were the only people that you would employ. So, you know, they didn't know what, you know, press this button to restart your game meant. So they would do the full grammatical legal English kind of way of saying it. So you get some really strange text strings and things like that. But no, bottom line, it was a case of there were some crazy bugs. I can't remember the game specifically, but there was a Virgin game back in the day, DOS. And when you used to put it in, and you're trying to sort out your video card and things like that, this big red screen turned up and said, whatever you do, don't say OK. You know, bad things will happen. You hit OK. It wipes your CD, well, it doesn't wipe your C drive. It wipes your auto execute and your config sys and puts on a DOS simple booting system. And mum phones up the following day and said, you've broken Jimmy's computer. Let me sort this out. And yeah. So there were things like that, but not the worst bug in the world was that one which was the big red screen that no one read.
What was that then, the big red screen?
Oh, well, it was one of these where you would set up the, you know, the Miles Gordon technology thing where you would set up the IRQs on your sound card. And it was something to do with that. Now, it wasn't specifically X-Wing, but it was around that time. It was one of those sort of, you know, we need to set up your graphics card for it. And even back in the day, I remember, what was it? Command and Conquer. And that had a really odd thing where one of the tech helpers who would answer the phones discovered that dependent what color your DOS 4GW error was would tell him what problem you've had. So you go, oh, right, yeah, you need to sort out your mouse driver, or you've got a high mem sys problem, or you've got, you know, your sound card doesn't work, it's on the wrong IRQ. And you'd be able to spot all of this just from the color of the error message. It was just random luck, but, you know, it worked.
Well, wrapping up the SCI kind of era, I mean, the Italian Job, was that the final title under SCI then? What kind of memories have you?
That was officially the final PlayStation title that they released. I can't remember if they did something like a Thunderbirds game thereafter or tie in it, something minor. But no, yeah, Italian Job was the final biggie. They were looking at games like, what was it, The Great Escape and things like that from other games companies and things like that. But this was from quite a reasonable company, Pixel Logic, at the time. They'd previously done, there was a War of the Worlds game that they'd done. And that really caught the eye of our producer, Pete, at the time. And he was a massive fan of War of the Worlds in all of its forms, just like I am, to be honest. And he was all over this, and it was like, oh, you know, they want to do the Italian Job. And yeah, I was a massive fan anyway. I'm one of these that loves pretty much anything that Michael Caine has ever been in. So loved every minute of that game, and sort of getting around doing the driving as well. And almost, as I was saying earlier, having to do a video of me doing the entire game so that Sony could see that it was at least completable. You know, we had quite a few phone calls towards the final dawn of like trying to get it to master, with Sony turning around saying, we don't think that chase scene is possible. So I had to do two or three different ways and even crash and show that, you know, even if you got it wrong, you could still do it. So all the fun of that, but no, great fun all the same. Loved it.
Well, Dave, kind of bringing us up to modern times then. I mean, I know you actually got to work on a Broken Sword game again last year. So what are you doing these days then? Kind of bring us up to speed on.
Well, in fairness, I didn't work on it. I literally got a credit because I was part of the original group and things like that. But I did pledge some money towards their Kickstarter and sort of applauded them from the sidelines and things like that. So no, I didn't actually do anything on Broken Sword this time round, but love the fact it was indeed, you know, it was almost like playing the game all over again. It was so great to see. And indeed, I was actually privy back in the day for listening to the old Dat Masters and things like that of Barrington and his orchestra and some of the outtakes that would happen and things like that. And indeed, it was like suddenly listening to everything at full bandwidth again. It was like, oh, you know, that's how it sounded. So, yeah, it was great. It almost literally put me back in York, sat there, you know, working on the game all over again in the corner behind Steve Ince. It was, yeah, great fun.
Are you still involved in the games industry today, then?
No, I'm not. I'm desperately trying to write an adventure game, an old school, you know, text or graphic adventure game or something like that. I've had a few ideas on my chest for decades now, and it's like I need to get it out. But no, unfortunately, it was like back in the day, it was like as things were evolving and the rest of it, I had a few family problems actually, and needed to close away and move away for some time out. And then, you know, dare I say it, the industry moved on. It moved on rather rapidly, and dare I say it, whilst I in some ways I might want to go back, I don't think I could do that job again. You know, times have changed. You know, I'm one of these, they love their retro and things like that. It was those games where you could play on your own, you could like spend your £30, whatever, you would have a proper £30 worth of fun. Nowadays, you end up spending close to £100 and get a sandbox to play in with other people, make up your own rules. Is that really value for money? Some people say it's a little bit, you know, insular or whatever, but you know, we all have those multiplayer games like Micro Machines, things like that. You know, get your mates over, unplug their joystick when no one's looking, you know, have that kind of banter and fun, you know, it's that kind of thing.
I'm sure in your muscle memory, Dave, as well, you've probably got some of those moves still down there. Complete a few games in one sitting, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I do go back on some games, and I almost don't need to look at the screen, but I still enjoy playing them, you know. And again, arcade games, you know, one of my go-tos, Strider, Outrun, you know, games like that, the classic Sega games, you know. But on top of that, I've been seen to jump into, you know, the old Command and Conquer, you know, the new 4K version. There's one game that I've been playing a lot of recently. I've got to give him a shout out. It's something called It Returned from the Desert. Now, I'm not sure if you remember the old It Came from the Desert. It's like a reimagining of that. And the best way to describe it is XCOM battle tactics alongside some retro themed It Came from the Desert. Fantastic game, I love it. It's peanuts to play and things like that. But yeah, I'm a whole retro junkie in my own right. I just love to go back on those games because, you know, it wasted hours of my childhood and my days, and you know, I still love go back and wasting even more time, you know, love it. Unfortunately, my job now, it's a bit more serious, you know, and things like that, working in an office, usual thing. I can't get away with half the kind of chat I used to get away with back in the day. But indeed, you know, from time to time, the old Virgin t-shirt might come out, or, you know, so something like really older than some of my colleagues will pop up and they go, oh, you can't wear that. And it's like, well, you know, a previous job at work employer did give me this, so, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. And then, you know, there's something rather rude written on it or whatever, but hey.
Keep it going, Dave. Yeah, I mean, you're in good company here, you know, all retro heads here. So, it's been amazing to hear some of your memories. And if you do write that text adventure game, definitely give us a shout. We'd love to chat a bit more about that. So, but in the meantime, thank you so much for coming on and being our guest this week. It's been great to hear some of your stories.
Absolutely fantastic. Great to hear from you both. And indeed, if want to chat again, or you suddenly like, oh, what happened then? Give me a shout. I'll quite happily spill the beans. I'm always up for a reunion if anyone else is out there.
podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.